A song of ascents of David. I was glad when they said to me, "Let us go to the house of the Lord. Our feet have been standing within your gates, O Jerusalem." Jerusalem, built as a city that is bound firmly together, to which the tribes go up, the tribes of the Lord, as was decreed for Israel, to give thanks to the name of the Lord. Their thrones for judgment were set, the thrones of the house of David. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May they be secure who love you. Peace be within your walls and security within your towers. For my brothers and companions' sake, I will say, peace be within you. For the sake of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek your good. I had a vision for my family and my house. We just moved after 27 years there. And this was my vision. I articulated it clearly to my children that the day after my funeral, they would be sitting at the kitchen table complaining in wonder about why I kept all this stuff. And that dream and vision was going well till the search committee here called me and ruined it. When I left that house, more seriously, the last day we were there, it's still emotional to recall, to leave a place where we raised our children. When the truck pulled away and the house was a mess and the cleaners were coming the next day, let me just say it wasn't pretty. But I comforted and consoled Sandy, and she did just fine. Or maybe it was the other way around. But the reason I bring that story up is part of living here is always going to be, for all people, certainly for God's people, deciding where your home is. And that's the journey of the Christian faith. Where will you truly live, and where will you find your place? So we go to a psalm this morning that's in a collection of psalms called the Psalms of Ascent that were sung by the pilgrims in Israel on their way to Jerusalem. And I want to ask you to think about where your home is now and will be forever. We'll do that by looking at the pilgrim's journey, and then we'll look at the pilgrim's prayers. The pilgrim's journey, I want to say, is always taken through time. Now, that sounds maybe so obvious that it shouldn't be the first point of a sermon about the pilgrimage, but it's really wrapped up in the whole story of the Psalms of Ascent. Because they are psalms that are related to a pattern of commanded and ordered pilgrimage that all the people of Israel were to take three times a year. They would make their way, and we'll talk about those in a moment, but first they would make their way up to Jerusalem. That is why they're called Psalms of Ascent. And in fact, if you study and look at the Hebrew, you can see they're structured verbally with their cadence in ways that can mimic verbally and in song an ascent upwards. They're going up and they're going through time. They're going up to Jerusalem, which is about just a little, the Temple Mount is a little under 2,500 feet up. So think about, like I live on Squawk Mountain, I think it's about 2,300 feet, does that sound right? And so it's a little higher than that, the pass is 3,000 feet. What's significant about the Temple Mount, of course, is that the temple was there, but people would always go up to it. In the old city of David, it's pretty high, but surrounded by the other mountains or hills or mountains really in the area, there are some that are taller. What is its significance? Why are we going up there? Well, because it's where Psalm 87 says God established his name and put his presence. They're going to that place that symbolizes the portal, the footstool perhaps is the more biblical world, between heaven and earth. And so the city of Jerusalem becomes for us a picture of our journey and way, not only from our home if we were Israelite in the promised land, but for all of us now who follow after the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, of our journey from earth towards and ultimately to, as we'll see, heaven. So that was the journey, and it was done through time. The first season in the early spring was Passover, a celebration of redemption. That feast was, you were commanded to attend it as a faithful Israelite. And then 50 days later, you would have gone to Pentecost. You had celebrated the provision of God. We celebrate those two in our own Christian calendar through the service of Good Friday, Easter, resurrection, and on. And then later on in the fall, a Feast of Booths, another celebration of God's provision in the wilderness. And so over time, Israel saw themselves in a pattern. Three times a year, they would be traveling through time. We do the same thing in our calendar. You're seeing that we've left up the Advent decorations. We're coming up on Epiphany, if we were celebrating that, it's in a couple days. But we're recognizing that time moves towards, that it's not indiscriminate, it's not perpetually serial, it's not cyclical, it's directional, and that's the message of redemptions. It was the message of the cycle of the people of Israel. And in fact, we don't need these grand feasts in order to understand this. It's the entire rhythm of the Sabbath day, of the Lord's day. It's why you clear out your days, Lord willing, and find your way here to acknowledge that you're traveling through time from now to then, or what will ultimately be. And the pilgrim's life is to be regulated in the direction of redemptive history and the acknowledgement that embedded, we could say, in the time-space continuum is a significance and a meaning and a purpose that we will align ourselves to by engaging in ritual that signifies its importance. So the pilgrimage in the Christian life recognizes that. This is what Aquinas said. Certain times are fitted for divine worship, lest man be wholly immersed in temporal affairs. We interrupt your life on Sundays to remind you of the ground and foundation and destiny of your life on every day. The pilgrim works and walks through time to, ultimately, as I said a moment ago, through time to our home. We're still looking at the pilgrim's journey. I was glad when they said to me, "Let us go to the house of the Lord." We're going to see that language at the end of the psalm. There's what we would call an inclusion, or to get fancy, an inclusio. The beginning verse says home, and the end verse says home, and they wrap us into our home. And that's where the journey is. But our home, to be truly home, to be a permanent, safe, peaceful, shalom-filled home, needs to be God's house. And he delights, he's glad, when the people of God, David is, would say to him, "Let us go to that place where we find the fullness, the intimacy, and the grandest presence of God in our midst." Now, as I've said before, and I will undoubtedly say again, God is everywhere. He is what we call omnipresent, but he manifests his presence according to his promises and his ordinances by the preaching of the word, by the prayers of his people, by his sacraments, baptism, and the Lord's Supper. And so when the Israelites would have gone to the temple, they would have been in the midst of all those means of grace, which we call them, that God delivered and communicated himself to them. And so that's what we're doing here. I will say it this way. God is more fully here than he will be anywhere else for you the rest of the week. and God will be with you in other places the rest of the week. But he brings the fullness of his people, the fullness of his sacraments, the fullness of his ordinances and worship to manifest his glory most completely here. And that's what the Israelites would have done. That's why it was his house. It was his footstool, his mercy seat, the place where his feasts were celebrated, the daily sacrifices, their freewill offerings. It's even so today, where I've said the preaching of the word they would have heard, and the songs of God's people, where they would have seen. Psalm 24 says, 27 says, I would be in the house of the Lord. One thing I would ask is to see the beauty of the Lord and the glory of his presence, of his temple. You are on a journey reflected in the pattern of our weekly Sabbaths. You are being reminded that you too, just like I had to, need to decide where your home is. Was it ultimately in the place where you worked hard for God's glory and the good of others all week? Or is your destiny, your destination, someplace else? Someplace more complete, someplace more full. C.S. Lewis said, if I have a longing for something that cannot be satisfied in this world, it may be evidence that I was made for something that's greater than this world. Ecclesiastes in the Old Testament put it this way: God has put eternity in the hearts of men, and they cannot discern its beginning from its end. We were made for more. Our home is ultimately going to be with God, or we will in a way live nowhere, which is the ultimate condemnation. But you might ask, well, this is great, Pastor, but this is all about Jerusalem and about the temple and about the people of Israel. But we're going to jump ahead now. I want you to hear me as I read from a New Testament book called the Book of Hebrews. This is what the writer of Hebrews says to the Christians of his day and ours. But you have come to Mount Zion, to the city of the living God, to the heavenly Jerusalem, to innumerable angels in festive gatherings, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, and to the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a new covenant, and to be sprinkled blood that speaks better than the blood of Abel. This is our destiny. We're enacting our ultimate home as imperfect and incomplete and broken and glorious and beautiful and ugly and painful and healing as it is. This is what we're doing. This is where we come. You know, there's two views of Seattle. One is the famous, perhaps the most beautiful city view, and I've traveled a fair bit, that I've ever seen, is taking the ferry back to Seattle at night from Bainbridge and to see the city. There's another view of Seattle. It's on Aurora, up by my old house. Those are two very different visions of the city, but they're both real. Neither one in this age eliminates or eclipses the other, and so it is with this glorious home you've been given, as we'll see. You have to go to this place. Not only is it in time, not only is the pilgrim's journey through time, to their home, but also, I am sorry to inform you, with a bunch of other people. And that's where our psalmist finds us now. The city that is bound firmly together, to which the tribes go up, the tribes of the Lord, as was decreed for Israel. Now, there's a lot there, but I want you to notice the tribes means it's not just you and it's not just your family. It's the people, as I've said over and over again, the people in this room, especially the people that aren't that you don't like. And I guarantee with this many people in a room, there's people that don't like each other. If that's a newsflash to you, I don't know where you've been for your whole life, but that's how rooms full of people work. There's also a deep and abiding love and a tolerance of one another here. But the idea that David comes up to this city He comes up to this place. He's delighted to be in it, and that the city, which all through the scriptures is much more than just a town or even a city or a polis, that is tightly bound together, is a message about the intimacy, about the metropolitan, if we could say that, of a smallish town and the time this was written, reality of living in close proximity, forced to deal with and love and serve and rely on one another. In fact, tightly bound together, that word is actually a word that means much more than proximity. It's also used for pacts and treaties that were between kings or greater and lesser individuals. And what he's reminding us, especially as he says, refers to the decrees of the Lord, is that God put us together, all his people, in a place according and bound by his law, which ultimately is an expression of love, that we might learn to serve and love one another. Now think about that. You are given by God to this church so that we can learn how to love you. And that might say that you're super lovable, okay? Maybe. It might also say that there's parts of you that are hard to love, and the people God sent you here so that people could learn to love people that are hard to love. That's true of both of us, including your pastor. I mean, of all of us, both of those things. The journey is taken through time to our home. Not my home, but our home, not alone, but together. That's what this is about. God wants us to be with one another. Yogi Berra said about a restaurant in New York, he said, that place is so crowded, no one goes there anymore. And the church, we're not that crowded, we have plenty of room, but the church forces us to deal with people. When I see a busy restaurant, I think two things. It must be good. I don't want to go in it. But you're forced. It's God's great love to give you one another. But that's not all. Those things are through time, to home. There's something that is more substantial, ultimate, and sometimes more problematic. I'm going to start by reading the opening lines of The Social Contract by Rousseau. Man is born free, and everywhere he is in chains. One thinks himself the master of others and still remains a greater slave than they. How did this change come about? I do not know. What can we make it legitimate? That question, I think I can answer. And he goes on to explain authority in the world. Here's Cliff Notes. He gets fundamental parts of it completely wrong. Now you don't have to read Social Contract. So, but other parts, he gets right. And that's been the way of humanity through all of history. Now, the reason I bring this up is because we're also, all of us, inescapably on a journey, not only through time, to home, with others, but also towards whatever is ultimate. We are towards what is ultimate. To which the tribes go up, the tribes of the Lord, as was decreed for Israel, to give thanks to the name of the Lord. There the thrones for judgment were set, the thrones of the house of David. The mishpat, the judgment, the decrees, the resolution, the declaration of justice, the judgment for every word and every deed committed, and those that should have been done, that should have been done and were not. Every human being longs for this. If you don't believe that every human being longs for this, then ask yourselves, why were there protests? Why are there courts? Why are we wounded? Why do we become offended? Because we live in a broken world that continually disappoints us or offends us, or more importantly, offends our sense of ultimately what is just. You cannot live life without some determination of who is right and what is wrong. It will be your own tribe. It will be your own nation. It could be your own religion. It's an inescapable part of the human condition. And the message of Christianity, of course, is that the thrones of David, the judgment of God, were ultimately given to us in the person of Jesus Christ. And so we give ourselves to him. Our journey is to him, where he sits enthroned over the heavens and the earth, meted out in his providence and ultimately resolved according to his purpose. Now that sounds perhaps like a grand declaration from a pastor of a smallish church in a part of the world that is doing pretty well. But I want to remind you that I believe that that's inherent in every individual, in every system. Rousseau tried to fix it. Marx tried to fix it. The founding fathers of America tried to fix it. Every time there's a protest, every time there's something on X about what went wrong, that's an expression of the human desire to find resolution for its brokenness, and our pilgrimage is about recognizing that. And the glory of the story of Christianity is that the one who will judge is also the one who suffered the brokenness and injustice of the world in its extreme. That Jesus, the Son of David, who sits now, according to the scriptures, all throughout the beginning to the end, he said, "All authority in heaven and earth has been given to me." That one understands betrayal, injustice, lived a life of love and compassion, and holiness too. And so he's given to the church to live that same thing out. Now, surely we have not lived that out at all times as well as we should, but in many times we have. We should get our church history from more than t-shirts and bumper stickers. But we can also look to efforts to find that resolution in anything else, and efforts without God in the picture have not worked out well for humanity, certainly in the last century. The reason this is part of our pilgrimage is because the one to whom you go, that ultimate resolution of all things, what your hope is to find comfort in loss and mercy when you need it and justice when it's been robbed, the one to whom you go, you will inescapably be on a journey to try to navigate that or find its resolution. And I say that the best place to find that, the ultimate only place to find that, will be in the one person who suffered everything that you want justice for and conquered it and promised to judge us for all things. It's an inescapable part of life is to wonder how its resolutions will be realized. To be sure, there's no golden age and there's no utopia in this place, but there is ultimately a true Jerusalem that Jesus will bring to us. This is how the Bible ends. "Then I saw a new heaven and a new earth, and the first heaven and the first earth had passed away, and the sea was no more. And I saw the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, prepared as a bride adorned to be her husband. And I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, 'Behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God will be with them and as their God, and he will wipe away every tear from their eyes.'" That's what the resolution, the restoration of the world looks like, and you and I were built to live for that. We will build it ourselves. We will ask our country to build it. We will ask our economy to build it. We will ask our philosophers to build it, or we will ask the Son of David, the Son of God, familiar with sufferings, acquainted with grief, betrayed by his friends, crucified by the world and resurrected from the dead. Those are the choices that are before us. And so this journey through time to home with others is for him, for him and to him who can explain and bring consolation and true judgment for all those things we walk through on our way to our ultimate home. So that's the pilgrim's journey. Let me say now a few words about the pilgrim's prayers. In the last part of the psalm, see if you can pick up the theme. I'll put an emphasis on the words. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. May they be secure who love you. Peace be within your walls and security within your towers. For my brothers and companions' sake, I will say, peace be within you. For the sake of the house of the Lord, I will seek your good or prosperity. Do you see the theme? There is an emphatic call to prayer. The longings that move you through time to your home with others for him will become your prayers, which will direct your life for peace and security and strength. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem. It's a beautiful Hebrew phrase. I won't butcher it with my Hebrew pronunciation, but if you could read it and have some understanding, it's this elegant, beautiful direction to pray for the peace of the city or place of peace. It's to pray in understanding that this journey that David's taking, this journey that we're taking, is done with flickering light, with shadows, with ebbs and flows, with storms and sun, an imperfect measure, and that we're longing and praying for the fullness of its reality with these glimpses that we can hold and realize here, but also encourage us until we get to that final destination we just heard from in the book of the Revelation. That's why this very purpose is why I am so earnestly pleading with us to become a church that is characterized by prayer. It is the only algorithm we have that we know in God's time will work. It's the only lever we can pull. It's the one thing that we can do that brings us directly into the presence of the King who rules over all things for the sake of his people and his glory. So pray for what exactly as you pray for the church? Pray for her security and her strength. May they be secure who love you. Peace be within your walls and security within your towers. The two images there inform us in our prayers about at least two parts of what our petition should cover. Within the walls is where the people would live, in a city surrounded by a protective wall. It's an emphasis on our fellowship and our communion with one another, our ability and eagerness to forgive, maybe even upstream from that, our desire not to offend in the first place, the way we use our time and our homes and the way we use our words with one another, that there would be shalom all across this, that our words would be full of grace and seasoned with salt for one another, and that the way we treat each other would reflect the way God has treated us. But then also, realizing that we're in a world that is broken, that loves evil, just like part of our own heart loves evil, we also want peace in our citadels, in our towers, our fortress, that we might be both secure and strong, might have watchful men and women attentive to those threats around us. And let me tell you about those threats. They're not quite as dramatic as we think. They're just the world and the flesh and the devil. You know, I would say this. It's different to be a Christian now in the West than it was when I became a Christian in the year 1380 or whenever that was. But, you know, here's the thing. I would say to you that the biggest threat about the culture now that you face as a Christian is not that you're going to be persecuted, although that can happen. The biggest threat is that you will be deceived by the deceitfulness of wealth and the worries of this world and the confusion of empathy and love. We need peace in our citadels, watchful eyes, attentive hearts. The best way to be safe is to watch your own heart, not your neighbor's. And then pray for her people. I hope you knew that you couldn't escape all of them. For my brothers and companions' sake, I will say, peace be within you. Listen to the language. There's familial connection and genuine affinity. And doesn't that reflect the nature of our relations with one another? I mean, we realize, as we're baptized and part of God's church, that we are bound together in familial connection, and that's foundational and ultimate, but that's different than companionship, as the language is, than affinity, which we're supposed to strive towards too. For their sake, your prayers should be lifted up for the sake of the people around you, that your family would find true companionship with one another. He brought this modest group together to live well with one another. And your heart, if you're on this journey, your heart should be not only moving through time with, to your home with others, but for others. And then one final thing here as we close out. For the sake of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek your good. That's the inclusion that I talked to you about, opening and closing. So what does it mean to be on this journey? In an irony, it's about looking for the prosperity and building the house you're not at home in just yet. Your prayers become the program of your life. The things we ask God for are the things we then ourselves strive for. For the sake of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek your good, your prosperity. I will wonder. I will work. I will give. I will worry. I will stay up late. I will show up early. I will cry. I will rejoice over what it is that happens here. I mean, you learn pretty soon as a pastor that no one thinks about your church as much as you do. It was my wife who told me that once when I was planning a church a long time ago. And it's good for us to know that. But I do know this. As true as that is, and as important it is for me to realize that you are not waiting for me to call you so you can learn what you can do for the church on a given day, is probably also true that having the church and its purposes and its Savior more forefronted in our minds and hearts would do our minds and hearts and the church well. Because this journey is an expression of our very life that we're living with one another. So I said you've got to choose. You've got to choose your home. I want to close with a couple readings from Robinson Crusoe. He left the island, he says. I left the island on the 19th of December. I found the ship's account, the year 1686. I had been upon it 8 and 20 years, 2 months, 19 days, being delivered from this second captivity the same day and month that I made my first escape or attempt. So he kept track of time, as you too in your pilgrimage should recognize that you are headed somewhere. As soon as I got on the board, he says, on board the ship, which was about noon, the captain ordered the anchor to be weighed, and as soon as it was done, the ship stood to the northward. And then I looked and took my last view of the island, which lay, as it were, sinking in the water, for it was very low land. So this place that consumed him for all these 28 years became smaller and smaller, and in a fashion sunk into the sea. And he says, finally, I took nothing with me but what was valuable. So that's what it is about. You have to choose where you're going to live. You have to decide, watching your time, and I can assure you that however long your journey is, you have less time today than you had yesterday. You must decide by watching the time, what is your island and what is your ship? And what is important to you? And if you do that, and you do it in Christ, your pilgrimage will itself be a song of ascent, and you will find your way into the heavenly Jerusalem with all God's other people.